next at Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat and but usually drink. Yeah, and it's snowing outside here in Indiana, in north central part of Indiana. It's starting to come down pretty good. Those are great big flakes, man. Wow. Yeah, it's pretty. It's pretty, yeah. But it gets about 3 feet deep. It's not so pretty. Okay, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And you can rant and rave on our phone number, 574-267-5036. And now we're going to go directly to the Big Apple. Yeah, and we're going to run down there on Wall Street and find Wall Street Lone Wolf. I know he's at his post down there. He's got some holes drilled in that wall. He's looking through and seeing what the hell they're doing down there. Let's see. Hey, I see him over there. Hey, Wall Street Lone Wolf, how you doing?
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, it's cold out here, isn't it, huh?
Yeah, dippy out here.
Well,
yeah, it's okay here, a little bit gray, but not bad.
Well,
not
you
bad.
Get up awful early to get out there and look through that wall when they're all coming to work down there at Wall Street.
Oh, yeah. I even see them clean up at night, so, you know, it's just...
What time do you have to get there in the morning to beat the crowd?
Well, actually, you know, these markets go around the clock, so... on the floor here, it's usually 5:30, 6. It starts becoming active. You know, the early risers are filtering in.
Well, do any of the Jews come in early?
The Jews never come in early, Tom.
Oh, I see. They have their they have their goyim come in for them, huh?
Yeah, their Shabbos goy.
Look, it looks like the thing's going to really take. Monday morning is going to be wild with this. The Senate turning down the bailout for the big three, huh?
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, now, is Richard Shelby, now, is he a lone wolf? I mean, he seems to be doing the right things for us.
He's doing the right things for Toyota, because he's got those Japanese plants in his state. You know, all those southern senators are funnier than a $3 bill. I mean, you know, they got these Jap manufacturers in their states, and of course they're going to be for that, you know.
Yeah, and these are the same guys that were, you know, they promoted these right to work for nothing committees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember those right to work for nothing?
Let me tell you something. I started out as a right winger, and I got into that way back in the early 60s, because that was a right wing thing to do. And I joined up with the right to work, and... then we had a big loss. There was a big lawsuit against Douglas Aircraft out there because the union was wanted to force us to pay union dues, and we weren't union members, and they called it agency shop. So I was very indignant about that. I mean, you know, if I hadn't joined the union, the union didn't get me the job, so I was pissed and joined up. And then they were going to sue Douglas, and they did sue Douglas, and they were going to use me as a test case. But this shows you how far back this race mixing goes. They decided to use this black guy with this white wife to be on the lawsuit. Well... gradually, I began to figure things out, and I didn't last with the right to work. You know, they're trying to use that against the GM workers, and but in reality, the GM workers are not making any more than the damn Jap outfits down south. I saw the figures on TV last night.
I think the real attack on the up north auto industry is because of the pensions and things like that. They want to cut those pensions out.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just all Jew think crap. And it's you know, I was going to say too, I almost forgot to mention it, and you've been mentioning it more and more. I know that the white race trader up at the upper levels in management, the CEOs and all that, they're disgusting, and ethically they're the worst possible. But I still think, at least within our race, but I still think the biggest problem we've got is allowing the Jew to get any place near our money. And, you know, if we ever get out of this, we absolutely have to keep that that person, that race, that criminal gang away from our money supply. Because if you keep them away, you know, I guess they can be useful in some ways, but once they get their hands on our pocketbooks, it's all over eventually.
It just never seems
to fail.
You got to have a big club, and every time they get close, you just hammer their hands, you know?
Yeah.
Put the hammer in a vice.
Give them some of those blue thumbs.
Unfortunately, I think it's sort of like parasites, like cockroaches. Yeah. You can't just sweep them out the door because they'll come right back. That's the problem with those people. If you could slap their hands and kick their ass, and they'd back off for at least a long time, it'd be different. But you can kick their ass, you can put them in an oven or whatever you want to do, and if there's any left, they're coming back at you.
That's true.
So, I mean, you know, we got a real problem there, plus the problems they create with the race and the immigration. So anyhow, what you're putting your money down on now? I mean, don't really tell me, but
as far as our folks go, I've got some good news and some bad news. And which one do you want first?
Oh well, as long as the good news is also bad news, I guess that's okay.
Oh okay.
See, bad news for them in the markets. Good news for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the good news is that most likely in 2 to 4 months we're going to have the major collapse. I don't think it's going to happen now, and that's the bad news. It's not going to happen right away, and the reason being is although Shelby was helping himself and us a little bit with his his recalcitrance there, but. I think what's going to happen, it smells like it, that even if Congress doesn't come through, the Treasury and Bush will come through. And what that will do will set up a precedent where they probably already done this, but then they'll have an upfront, out in the open precedent set where the Treasury and the Fed mixed in, the whole gamut of them, will be buying stocks, will be actually... in effect, nationalizing industries.
Well, yeah, why don't they just go ahead and call it the United States Motor Company and take it over? I mean, you know, they might as well.
Oh, I think that's what they're going to do, and they'll probably do it over the weekend. My thing about, and they don't have to, though. Now, I don't know the future. This could be the, we've already had, this collapse is going to be, I believe, a two-stage collapse, and we've already had the first foot. We've already had the first collapse, which is the biggest, stock market trouncing in history. And that's what happened over the last 2 months. But the second step will be another trouncing and also possibly the collapse of the monetary system itself.
You know, one thing that really upsets me is how the workers attack the workers. And I hear a lot on right-wing radio.
Yep.
To where these people come in there and attack the workers because they're making they're making too much money. I mean, it's like a jealousy thing.
It's envy.
And I was talking to a businessman yesterday, and he pissed me off. He said, "Well, they got that standard conservative right wing line. Well, white people won't work." Well,
yeah,
I said,
right.
They're not going to live in a cardboard box or in the back of a car or 50 families in an apartment. Of course they're not going to do that, so you're going to have to pay them. Oh, they won't work. I said, you know, there are plenty of white people that will work, and there's the higher percentage of white people that will work than Mexicans, I'll tell you that, because they get a chance, and they're on their ass in a minute, you know, under a shade tree. They walk right off the job and go back to Mexico and don't even give any notice, you know.
Yep. There are problem workers on the white side, but most of that has been inculcated by this Jew media.
Well, most of it is drugs.
And the same thing.
Yeah.
The Jews, you know,
right.
Most of it emanates from them sooner or later. But if you leave, most white people want to do a good job. In fact, a good thing that I learned a long time ago was, you know, the old saying, to do a job large or small, do it right or not at all. And I can guarantee you, no mestizo or Indian or black ever came up with that statement.
Right.
You know that is the heart and soul of
also one of the big things with workers is you got to make them feel like they're appreciated too. And I think management has this the golf course attitude about the working man.
Well, and these are this kind of management you're talking about is this Jew influence management. Maybe Jews. Well, as a matter of fact, I find that Jewish management, when you work for them, they're actually very protective of their workers. They tend to be more than your white types. Your white types tend to be the envious types, like the workers being envious of others. But I happen to have found that if you actually go to I worked in the garment district area in New York, and they were very, very protective. But, you know, it's the kind of protectiveness that's sort of paternal of pets almost.
Well, you know, when I was at Douglas Aircraft in Santa Monica back in the early 60s, Douglas Sr., the old man, used to come right down on the floor and walk around the labs and everything else, and he knew a lot of people had been there for years. Hi, Charlie. Hi, Joe. How's it going? How's the family? And like that. And the people loved old Donald Douglas Sr. Of course, when his son took over, he was a bastard. He didn't give a shit for nothing but, you know, money. And everything went to hell after that. But a lot of the old-time manufacturers had a better relationship with the workers, you know.
That's exactly what happened at Ford Motor Company. When Henry Ford II wasn't the son of the original Henry, he was the son of Edsel Ford. But this guy was a real slime bucket, Henry Ford II, a real sleaze bag. He was in bed with the Jews. He's the one that gave up the Ford Foundation to the Jews and brought in the Jewish accountants. And that was the end of Ford Motor Company. It's just a matter of time. And,
right.
But Henry, the original, was great. And then he got caught up with the the right wing types. I forget the name of the guy that he had as his big manager, but he was really a brute force guy.
Yeah, and he was the British Israel guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he was into it during that period when British Israel was sort of morphing itself into sort of the identity thing, even though they didn't call it identity. But I can't remember his name either. But I read about him quite a bit.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, he's really a hammer.
And he's the one who apologized to the Jews too. Henry Ford never did. They wanted an apology from Henry Ford. He would never apologize to him. But this right hand man said he apologized to him, but he didn't.
Yeah, gutless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Typical right winger. Yeah.
Right.
Well,
the only thing that bothers me about Henry Ford was, now, he was very sharp, and I liked his books on the Jews and everything, but whatever possessed him to go over there right after the Reds and the Jews took over in Russia, being so anti-Jew that he was, and build a damn truck factory that was converted to a tank factory in World War II. I mean, that shows that he wasn't quite as sharp as maybe people think he was.
Yeah, I don't know the details on that. I have to think, though, with all his knowledge, that the Jews were behind the Bolshevik Revolution and also his international, what the heck was it? The International Jew, his book, and his Dearborn Independent. With all that knowledge, maybe there's more there than we know about. Maybe that faction that was in charge of that truck plant really wasn't the Red Faction. But they got taken out.
Well, if they hadn't been the Red Faction, they'd have been a dead faction, because Stalin was firmly in control and the Cheka was running around killing anybody that even said anything. So there was hardly any White Army or anything else left. I mean,
the White Army was over with by, I think, 1920 or so.
Well, maybe some of the old-timers out there may have an answer to that, but I've always been puzzled about that. Why, after writing the book about the Jews, he would go over there and build a truck plant?
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
Sometimes people do odd things, people in power, you know.
Well,
anyhow, now, wait a minute. Now, this, what the hell these Japanese plants going to do? Because a lot of the parts makers make for GM and the Japs. I mean, what if they're going to GM's going to go down a tube? What about all these parts manufacturers that are building parts for the Japanese plants?
Well, they'll still keep building parts for the Japanese plants on a lesser basis, but I don't know how this is going to pan out yet. You know, we're kind of jumping the gun here. We don't know how this is going to pan out. We won't know for the next few days. But I think we're going to know by next Tuesday.
So you think Bush is going to jump into it? And
I kind of get that smell, and I think it might have been the plan all along. This Shelby thing sounds like real BS to me. I know he's got the Japanese plants down there, all that stuff. But there's more to it than that, because it's too much in your face to the auto workers. I mean, let's face it. If these auto workers had any balls at all and they did that, these guys should really get the scopes out. I mean,
but one thing to remember is it was the UAW that furnished tons of money for people to oppose Shelby and these guys, these Republicans down south, and these Republican guys don't forget that, and they're probably saying, "Well, you screwed with me, and I almost lost the election. Now I'm going to screw with you." Maybe it's just as simple as that.
Well, it could be. I just think it's deeper than that. This is too big, and this is a huge issue. I mean, let me tell you what happened last night. I've never seen it before, and I got up specifically to watch it, and the yen, the U.S. dollar yen conversion ratio dropped by, I think it was over 2 points, maybe two and a half points in the space of maybe 10 minutes. Now, I can't explain to you what that is, but that's trillions of dollars, you know, just sloshing someplace. Who knows where it is? But that was all when it was determined sometime, I think it was, I forget the exact time, but it was after 10 o'clock at night, Eastern. And it could have even been in the morning, I'm not sure.
Well, I was concerned. I couldn't figure out how, the Republican Party usually doesn't have much balls, but I mean, this, I couldn't figure out how they were standing up so strong against this, because they're already on the ropes with the working class, you know.
That's my point. That's why I think it's all a setup. I think the whole thing is scripted. I think what could, the way I'm looking at it right now, is what could happen is, Congress has essentially said they're not going to do anything, at least not till next year, which means that's too late. And I think Bush then will come in with Paulson and all those people and set the precedent of actually investing directly into companies and essentially nationalizing them, which, by the way, they've probably already been doing, because they are not revealing who they have, you know, how they have distributed all these funds.
Well, the other point is, though, how can they hold on that long? I mean, these guys, I mean, they're talking about we need $4 or $5 billion just to get along for a few weeks or something like that.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. Congress has already okayed those other funds. So what I'm saying is we will know by Monday or Tuesday, if not today, over the weekend, sometime in the next 5 days or so, and I'm putting the end at Tuesday as being as late as it will go, that what I think will happen is Bush will come out and say, well, you know, Congress wouldn't do it, so we'll do it, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, these guys just do whatever they want to do, and the whole thing looks like a script to me.
Well, I think it's going to be quite interesting when the bell rings Monday morning, don't you?
Let's see what happens today first.
Well, that's true. This is Friday. I keep thinking this is Saturday. Yeah, it hasn't even rung yet today, has it?
Well, the way it's panning out today, they had the big down overnight in Asia and Europe, and today it wasn't as bad. And yesterday it was a big down at the end of the day, but it was on lighter volume, which I know to most of our folks doesn't mean much, but it means that it isn't as realistic as it would be if it was heavy volume down. Well, and now they're bouncing a little bit. They're just going to bounce around here. Bush may come out today. I think what they're also doing, Tom, I think it's a script, and I think all the insiders know the script, and I think they're making billions of dollars on these markets today, yesterday, today, and if it runs into Monday and Tuesday, they'll probably stretch it out till Tuesday and make just incredible amounts of money because they know the exact turn points. They know when Bush will make his statement. These people are so crooked that, like I said at the outset, we have to get these kike Jews out of this banking and money and credit system.
Have you been watching the European news at all? You see the riots are spreading all over Europe?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that was just off, almost an inane event. You know, I mean, it was a big deal for the kid. Some kid got shot, and I think he was killed, but he was throwing bricks or something through, they were rioting to begin with. They were, for some reason.
Well, you're talking about in Greece?
In Greece.
Interesting thing there is that the so-called neo-Nazis teamed up with the cops.
That's what they said, but you know, you never know what the details are. Let me give you an example. There was an article, the last News and Views had an article about the Tamil Tigers. Did you get a chance to read that?
No, I missed that.
Oh, well, it's the second article. It's on the top section. It's the second article down. And the really interesting thing about the Tamil Tigers is that they are the radical, they are true terrorists. They are trained in India, and they are in Ceylon, the old Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka, and they are true terrorists against the people who are the indigenous peoples of Sri Lanka.
Well, I know the Tamil Tigers, they're the darling of the left-wing social Marxists. I know the progressives are really hot for those guys.
My point is that in that case, the government are the good, well, if there are good guys and bad guys, and I think from our perspective, although none of them are good from our perspective because none of them have anything to do with our race, but from a similar perspective, to us, the Tamils would be similar to blacks or mestizos or Meds in general.
But why? Whether the tactic would not that would not be a correct tactic, though. The tactic would be lay back and let the system fall and then move in. I mean,
but my point is that the good guys, from our perspective, in Sri Lanka, is the government itself. The government itself, actually, they are the indigenous people. They are, from our perspective, if we were up here in North America, they would be the white government in North America. We're down there. They're the Sinhalese indigenous government down there. So in that situation, the government itself are the good guys. So my whole point is that not every time is the government the bad guy. And possibly in Greece. I don't know Greece politics.
Well, one thing I'd like to ask is, what do they mean, neo-Nazis? That could be about anything. I mean,
exactly. Now,
I mean, are they racial or what? I mean, you know, some of these European neo-Nazis are not racial; they're just nationalists. You know.
Well, exactly. That's very true. But so we have two questions there. Number one, is the government what we would consider the good guys in that situation? We don't know yet. We're just taking on face that every government is bad. Well, that's the problem with anarchists. The anarchists are against anything, even good things. Now, that Greek government could be a good government. I don't know that much about Greek politics to know whether it's good or bad. Now, if it happened to be a good or relatively good government, and these neo-Nazis happen to be also racial and were supporting them, in that case, it wouldn't be bad. You know what, Tom? We don't have enough information.
That's true, but I still have a problem with seeing it in print.
Right.
So-called neo-Nazis teaming up with the state. That gives me a problem.
I know. I'm just playing the devil's advocate there, saying that neither one of us are 100% sure what's going on.
That's very correct. Well, that's about it then for today, huh?
Sounds good to me. And, these markets just opened up a minute ago, and they opened up a couple hundred points down, and I don't know, I think they're going to flop around. I think my analysis may be correct. We'll find out. We've got five to find out.
Get back to me maybe later today, and then, of course, Monday morning we'll have to touch base too.
Maybe we should. Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Okay, Wall Street Lone Wolf, you can get your eyeball out of that hole now and run for cover, okay?
Five words and 14 words.
Five words and 14. We'll see you. Well, look, Lone Wolf Wall Street got on the phone. He said, I got more stuff for you. I got to talk about this. So I got him back on the phone here. Go ahead, Lone Wolf Wall Street. You got the floor.
Well, just a few things, Tom. First, about this Governor Blagojevich. Apparently, the night before the FBI arrested him, the day before, he told all his state executives not to have any dealings with Bank of America because Bank of America was not supporting a firm, one of the firms which employed a bunch of people in his state. So he was going to bat for the workers there. And it's just interesting that less than 12 hours after that took place, he's arrested by the FBI. And that whole ball of wax takes place. You know, in Washington, D.C., they have a thing called the control file on any person of importance. And they also have control files on important people around the country. So that any time anybody gets too much out of line, they can threaten them that they'll do something.
And Hilaire Belloc, who wrote, I think the name of the book was, but anyhow, he talked about a basket of eels. And that's what this corruption's like. You reach into a basket of eels like snakes, you try to get a hold of the tail of a snake, and you don't know which one you're going to get. And everything's so screwed up that there's crooks on all sides. I mean, you know.
Yeah, it seems like any time the Jews get close to anything, it just gets dirtier and dirtier.
Well, I just hope it broadens out, this thing. And, I could tell by the way Obama was speaking on television yesterday, he started stuttering, and he tends to stutter when he's got a problem.
Also, he might have had to be a bit extemporaneous, and when he is, I don't think that guy is nearly as sharp or as good as people think he is, because a few times he lost his scripter, I forget what they call it, but a few times he lost it during the campaign, and he turned into a blithering idiot. So, this is going to be interesting. Plus, we haven't heard back yet about this Supreme Court case. Interestingly, you'd think the right wing would be all over it.
Well, they turned it down. They refused to hear it.
Did they turn it down?
Yes.
Okay, I hadn't heard that. Well,
which is very interesting. I mean, you know, they could have put, even if they'd have decided in favor of Obama, they'd put a lot of to rest, because all these people out there want to... They're arguing like hell. Oh, no, that's not true. That's all BS and the whole bit, you know.
Yeah.
And I
run
into it around here. So you were talking about Sri Lanka. Now, what's
yeah, going on? Actually, it does relate to Sri Lanka. But the other thing I wanted to mention about was this Mumbai attack.
Yeah.
And what happened the day before the Mumbai attack occurred, and this is all factual. There's no mistaking this. It's not like it's a rumor or anything. I think the attack took place on the 27th, but on the 26th, the head of the anti-terrorism unit of India, he didn't believe that 2 months before, other bomb attacks had taken place, and the main government in India wanted to blame it on the Muslims. Well, this guy didn't believe it, and he did investigation, and he found out. Apparently, he found out that the Mossad were the ones behind it, and he got witnesses that were involved in that previous attack, and they pointed out Mossad agents. He got the Mossad agents, and who knows how he interrogated them, but he got them to reveal. Well, whether that is true or not, you know, it's possible, Tom, that information has been added, but for a fact... He was assassinated the day before the attacks on the 27th, and also five of his associates, close associates, that were supposedly in on this previous investigation were also assassinated.
I thought he was the one who went first in, and he got shot right away by the terrorist.
That was the story, and that may be true. But it was way early. He was shot way early. He was in his Jeep. Apparently in his Jeep, he had his flak jacket on, he had his helmet on, and he was shot in the back of the head.
Oh.
So there's more there than meets the eye. That's probably the story they and that could be true. But it is interesting that not too many people got killed, except the head of the anti-terrorism unit and his five closest associates in that previous investigation.
Well, there was 190 people I heard got killed.
Well, no, I'm talking about of the people from the outside, the army and the police people, SWAT team people like that.
Right.
I think he was the only one that got killed. Maybe there were a few others, but other than his associates.
What I thought was amusing, and I mentioned it, all these troops showed up in the trucks, and they all had woods, camouflage, leaves and stuff all over their helmets. And here they were in the city going to do an operation. I thought that was funny, you know. Is this the end of the end now?
This is the end of the end.
Okay, I'll talk to you later.
We'll begin the beginning some other time.
Right, 14-5.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network calling, and it is December the 12th, 2008. Friday, Freya's Day, evening you get your lady, bring her home some flowers, take her out to dinner, take her out to the movies, take her out mountain climbing, whatever turns your crank, but get her out of the kitchen. Yeah. Well, it's a fairly nice day here in the heartland. Yeah. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network calling. It is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, here at the bunker by Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern. Yeah, where the elite meet to drink most of the time. Once in a while they have a hot dog or one of those pig's feet in the jar there, you know. Well, I guess what we're going to have, I think we're going to have Guerrilla Radio Man on again. He's really getting hot over there, man. He's got a lot to say, so let's get him on here and see what he's got to say. Don't forget our P.O. Box, 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, telephone 574-267-5036. Do it today, right.
Guerrilla Radio calling. Guerrilla Radio calling. Guerrilla Radio calling. I'm your host, Frank Bauer, a denizen of Cook County, which has now been renamed Cook County. You know, I mean, that's just the way it goes with Chicago there. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. Guerrilla Radio calling. Guerrilla Radio calling. Guerrilla Radio calling. I'm your host, Frank Bauer, a denizen of Cook County, which should now be renamed Crook County. You know, I mean, that's just the way it goes when you live in the Chicago metropolitan area. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. Al-Qaeda, if you have any plans for any action in the United States, I welcome your action in Chicago. If you like the nice, cuddly shows about race and how bad the blacks and Jews are, this show isn't for you. If you want me to talk about how we can distribute literature or how we should protest things, this show is not for you. This show is for the one percenters, the fanatical, white separatist, pan-Aryan racist, who are sick and tired of the run-of-the-mill tactics that have been tried for decade after decade while our race goes to shit in this country. If you want me to talk about dead tactics, this show is not for you. You can turn me the fuck off right now. One of the shows I did a number of months ago, I was reading out of The War of the Flea. I have that book back now. And I remember the last show I did on War of the Flea, I ended it at the beginning of Chapter 8, dealing with the Cypriot insurgency on the island of Cyprus under the leadership of General Grivas, who was fighting against the British occupation. And I got to tell you, this guy is a stud with a capital S. I really like this guy. And I encourage you to contact the Insurgent, get a copy of War of the Flea if you haven't done so already. You need to also get a copy of We Shall Fight in the Streets and 101 Questions for a Guerrilla. You need to get these books. You need to read them. You need to study them. And you need to keep them in an area or in a storage facility or somewhere where you don't live. You need to keep all your racially orientated reading, your pamphlets, or maybe you have black propaganda flyers you want to distribute, but you don't keep them at home. Okay. I want to pick it up in beginning of chapter 8. This is General Grebas of the Cypriot insurgency in Greece. And he says, and this is a quote from his memoirs, it says, "The British, who arm their commandos with knives and instruct them to kill from the rear, protested vigorously when such tactics were applied to themselves. It may be argued that these things are only permissible in war. This is nonsense. I was fighting a war in Cyprus against the British, and if they did not recognize the fact from the start that they were forced to at the end. The truth is that our form of war, in which a few hundred fell in 4 years, was more selective than most. And I speak as one who has seen battlefields covered with dead. We did not strike like a bomber at random. We only shot British servicemen who would have killed us if they had fired the first shot, and civilians who were traitors or intelligence agents. To shoot down your enemies in the street may seem unprecedented, but I was not looking for results. But I was looking for results, not precedents. How did Napoleon win his victories? He took his opponents in the rear or flank. And what is right on the grand scale is not wrong when the scale is reduced and the odds are against you 100 to 1. Man, that sums it up right there. I love that quote. I love how chapter 8 begins with that quote from him, because that initially talks about us. And not only us white separatists, racists, us anarcho-white racists, in America, but it talks about you, you British insurgents, French, German, and you know, I like to think, you know, I like to fantasize that these shows of the insurgent radio are going all over the world, and all you white-skinned bipeds of the human species, you know, take Tom Metzger's advice about not talking to the police and not partaking in any demonstrations wearing a swastika or a placard saying, you know, save the white race. You know what? Them days are done. You know, if we're going to follow those tactics, you know, we might as well just admit that we're just partaking in mental masturbation, you know, because it's not going to get anything accomplished. But this guy, he said, you know, he wasn't looking for presidents. He was looking for results. And if you're outnumbered as we are outnumbered on all fronts against the system. We are outnumbered in the job, you know, your place at work. We are outnumbered in the schools. We are outnumbered in the military. We are outnumbered in our government. There's nobody in our government that thinks like us. And if there's anyone in our government that thinks even remotely close to what we believe, we would probably have to characterize them as, you know, the right wing, which we want no part of. We wouldn't mind the white wing or the right wing to disappear permanently. Carrying on, it says here the words from the memoirs of the EOKA leader, General George Grebas, the subject, terror. Although Grebas is the archetype of the conservative military, turning the page here, conservative military man, a jingle and a fascist in the eyes of the Greek communists, this philosophy of terrorism approaches that of the anarchist. The state exercises authority by the use of the threat of force, argued the anarchist. We can agree with that. As an anarcho-racist, as a racial nihilist. By the way, the term racial nihilist I got, and I don't remember
what book it was I bought from War years ago. But it was basically about a guy who married this girl, who had a job, and they had a baby, had a young daughter, and the daughter was raised into her teen years, and then she was raped and killed by some niggers, and he lost his job to some Mexicans, and they formed the Aryan Partisan Army. I don't remember the name of that booklet that Metzger published, but that's where I got the term racial nihilist. And that's what we are. The policeman on the corner is the agent as well as the symbol of the system. And the revolver, or in this case the Glock 9mm or Sig Sauer 9mm, a lot of forces I believe are switching over to Sig. Sidearm at his side is there to intimidate or in the extremity to kill those who resist him. If then his authority is illicit, being exercised without the just consent of the governed, it is no right and natural to oppose force with force. To kill policemen as one would kill bandits, and to combat usurpers as one would combat an invasion. In effect, this was the reason that led Grivas, a Greek Cypriot, to declare war on the British rulers of Greece and Turkish Cyprus. Carrying on, it says, in his memoirs he writes that it was a deep regret, but with a high sense of duty, that he took up arms in 1955 against an old friend and ally, Britain. He blames not the British people, but a band of politicians who denied even the hope of freedom to Cyprus, and he demands, or he adds, it is on their heads that the guilt rest for the death of so many men, women, and children in the tragic years that followed. You know, he says that it wasn't the British people's fault. And, you know, he lived in a different time, in a different place. And what I like about this guy, I don't believe at any one time he had more than, I believe he had over just a little over 100 insurgents on an island occupied by thousands, not to mention the 2,000 British Expeditionary Force that occupied Greece. But he never worked in more than teams of five or six, and he was pretty successful. I believe he got his training in that type of fighting against the German occupation in the 40s, so, you know, take the good with the bad. Okay, in the beginning of the Cypriot struggle for independence was announced on March 31st, 1955 by a series of explosions across the island. Saboteurs raiding the government radio station in Nicosia set off bombs that wrecked the broadcasting equipment and lifted the roof from the building, causing damage estimated at 60,000 pounds. Bombs were thrown into government office buildings and into the wireless installations of the Worsley barracks, headquarters of the British military force, which at that time numbered only 4,000 men. In the port of Limassol, a power plant and two main police stations were bombed. In Larnaca, the police headquarters and the courts and the British commissioner's office were all shattered by bomb blasts. The first casualty of the campaign occurred in Famagusta. A member of the EOKA, which was Grivas's insurgency force group, was electrocuted when he threw a damp rope over high tension wire in an attempt to sabotage the electrical supply. The attack took the world by surprise, and colonial officials were stunned and panic-stricken, says Grivas. You know, it's a pretty decent idea, I guess, to throw a grappling hook over a wire like that, but I guess you would want the wire to be dry, or your rope to be dry. There's a lot of power going through these high-tension wires. I would find a different way to sabotage them. If we come under Chinese occupation, wink, wink. Okay. I want to get as much reading as done, because this guy, this is a very interesting chapter. By the wave of bombing attacks was coupled with more general political action. Young students and school children were rapidly recruited into the independent movement. I intended to turn the youth of Cyprus into the seabed of the EOKA, writes Gleevas, and a series of successful demonstrations was organized, sufficiently violent to drive police from the streets and to require the use of soldiers to restore order. Children as young as 10 years old were used to distribute leaflets, to act as couriers. Teachers were inferred to disregard. Wait a minute. Hold on. Like I said, I got to do my shows in a room that's poorly lit, and I can do nothing about that. Okay, teachers who interfered and disregarded the organization's warning were punished. Okay, so that means, you know, I mean, how often have we ran into that? You know, I mean, our own worst enemy in this country and probably abroad are other white-skinned people, more so than blacks and brown and yellow. So in order to get a sizable percentage of people of our race on our side, we need to treat the enemies of the white race who are white with the utmost extreme ruthlessness and brutality. You are not going to win them over in a debate. You're not going to give them a booklet, Who Rules America, you know, talking about the Jewish media control. They don't care. They, you know, too many white people only care about their own comfort and their own furnishings in their home and their house, which is nothing but a big box to collect more shit. You know, we need to appeal to the most base primal instinct of the human species, and that's fear. We need to be feared. Right now, we're a joke. We need to be feared. Okay, children as young as 10 years old were used to this. I read that. All right, pressure was put on Cypriot newspapers that were slow to take the right tone with regard to the campaign. For example, newspapers that failed to denounce the passage of repressive laws, those of weak spirit, soon felt the weight of the EOKA boycott. I can think of another way to influence them, but that'll do for them. All right, a wave of terrorism that has been initiated by an extremely small group of men. Extremely small group of men. Not more than 80, according to Gribas, organized into sabotage squads of 5 and 6 in all of the principal cities and towns of the island. There were as yet no guerrilla units, although Gribas has personally reconnoitered the island, making notes of favorable places for ambushes, terrain suitable to provide bases for guerrilla action, and so on. You know, this kind of goes with what I had to say on Sunday, my last show that Tom let me do. You know, I talked about not doing any action anywhere close to where you live or where you work. And then you want to pick a town or a city that you or your family or your friends have no connection to. You know, that like if you went out of town one week and you came back to your friends on Monday morning and said, yeah, I went to Minneapolis, Minnesota this weekend. And, you know, your friends know that you have no connection. And you say, what the hell did you go there for? That's the type of distance you want to cover. And believe me, you can cover a lot of distance in a 6-hour drive, if you were so inclined. But you can do a lot of research even before you go, even before you depart your hometown. You can get to know an area like the back of your hand, as well as you know your own hometown. But it's when you get in that town and you walk the ground, you walk the neighborhoods, you make special note of where you would conduct an ambush. This would be a great ambush right here. And my egress, my escape and evade from that ambush site will be through here. You can do that initially through a map reconnaissance. I've said this before. And then you would look at satellite photos that you could find on Google to confirm whether you like that avenue of approach or not. Whether you like an avenue of approach or an avenue of egress, your escape and evade route. Now, satellite photos look top down, so you can't really see fences and barbed wire fences and other obstacles because you're looking top down. But you click on street view, and whatever streets are highlighted in blue, you know, you can drag your little stick figure onto where you want to do a search. Like, I've done that before. I look on a map, and I'm like, I couldn't tell whether these railroad tracks ran under a street or over a street. If they ran over a street, and I want to follow these tracks, well, I could be seen walking on the tracks from the street below. And most of the streets would be well lit up. But I like tracks that go under the street, because there's no light down there. And I can stay in the shadows all night long if I have to. So, you know, but it doesn't hurt to know your area. I mean, to know the shortcuts to get from point A to point B that somebody in a mounted patrol may not know that passage or may not be able to follow you, not unless he dismounts his vehicle and chases you on foot. Okay, that's something to think about. Know your area, know it well. Okay. The excellent network of roads across the island militated against the extensive guerrilla campaign, and most of those who were to fight as guerrillas were not sent into the countryside until they have outlived their usefulness in the towns. By becoming too well known to risk being seen in the streets, the mountains of Kyrenia, the mountains of the Kyrenia Range and the heavily wooded Kudos Range in the southwest were, however, subsequently used as base of guerrilla operations for the training of sabotage teams. Like I said before, I'm not really a big fan of establishing bases in the woods. You know, I think of the CSA, the covenant of the arm of the sword of the Lord, or whatever they were. You know, I mean, you know, the FBI found out where they were. They had them completely surrounded. If they wanted to escape and evade from there, it was next to impossible. The FBI agents were in full cover and concealment, like they were a Special Forces Delta Force Army unit or something. I mean, I don't recommend those tactics in America today. And you can only get away with something like that if the system was severely weakened, where they didn't have the resources to send into the world and do reconnaissance and possible ambushes against us. But one thing we could learn from this, if you're a well-known racial figure in your town, you know, it is not conducive for you to do lone wolf activity, because you will be a usual suspect. If you're married and have kids, it would be really hard for you to get away for the weekend and go somewhere and do whatever kind of lone wolf op you see fit. Also, I want to stress real important here that when you embark on your operation, you know you're driving, you're on the interstate, you're going to whatever city you're going to. When you get to that town you're going to, you absolutely do not use any credit cards for anything. If you think, oh, wow, I forgot a certain tool that I need. I need to go to Ace Hardware or Home Depot and pick up that tool. And most of the times, you know, the clerk will ask you, do you have a rewards card? You know, they scan the card and you purchase so many items and they give you a discount on things in the future. You don't want nothing to do with that stuff. You pay for cash for everything. You know, if you have one of these iPasses, it's called an iPass in Illinois. It's where you can go through the tolls and some laser beam or whatever is connected to a device you have in your car, and you get a bill in the mail later. You know, don't go through those toll booths. You pay, if you have to go through a toll, you pay the change. And you disconnect your iPass if you have to. Just in case, it may get a reading anyways, even though you paid at the coin station. So, absolutely no cell phones. Make sure your car is in good working order. Make sure your tires are rotated. Make sure they have the correct amount of pressure. You know, it's great if you go right after you get a tune-up or an oil change. I mean, your car needs to be in tip-top condition. If you want to go the rented car route, you can do that. You know, I was watching the Bourne Supremacy the other night, and after Matt Damon's character, Jason Bourne, neutralized a certain CIA agent who had him in custody, he had in his bag a trickster. He had a license plate with magnetic backing that he just put right over the CIA agent's license plate. You know, the one that he neutralized. He took his car, and he had a license plate, a fake license plate, ready. So because the agent's car would be missing, so there'd be a bolo put out for that car, you know, be on the lookout for this car because it was stolen from wherever. But you can do that. You can get a license plate, and you can get some super glue and super glue some magnetic backing on the back of the license, and you can put it on the old plate. You know, you don't have to go through the whole thing of undoing the screws on your own license plate, putting the fake one on, and then putting the other one in your trunk. You don't have to do that. You know, just get a lot of magnetic stripping, super glue to the back of a fake plate, and put it on there. Make sure you don't have a out-of-date sticker on there. Make sure if you grab a plate, the sticker for the plate has not been expired. So, something you want to keep an eye on. Okay. I think I need to flip the page here. Let me read this. Comically, the British did not take this piece of information seriously, recalls Greenboss. The idea of an elderly retired officer as the leader of the EOKA was too strange for them to accept. Digenis, I think his code name was, and he didn't go by the name of Greenboss. He went by the name of D-I-G-H-E-N-I-S. Digenis, I guess it's called. Continued to move about freely in the thin disguise of dark glasses and a clipped mustache. For a time, he established a headquarters in the mountains, but later he relates he hid in a house in Limassol for 2 years without being discovered or betrayed. You see, the British, you know, I didn't read a lot of I left out a big chunk of reading here to save on time. But the British just couldn't get it in their heads that it was this old guy that was doing all this, or that was the leader of this. You know, and that's the best thing you can do. You want to, the part of the mind of your enemy you want to hang out in is his stereotypes of certain things. I did a little experiment last weekend. I dressed in clothes that were uncharacteristic of me. I've been talking about this before. I wore a hat uncharacteristic of me. I didn't have my glasses on. I had contacts in. I had I put a dot of camouflage paint on my cheek to make it look like a mole, and I put another one on my chin. I didn't look like myself. And I walked down a main street where I know people in this town would know me. And I was, in some cases, I was a foot away from people who know me, who've been known me for years. They didn't recognize me. Because they have it in their minds that Frank Bauer dressed a certain way, walks a certain way, carries himself a certain way, and talks a certain way. And I do this for practice. You know, I'll talk in a mannerism that's uncharacteristic of me. I all the time I practice a New England accent, you know, park the car behind the bar, get a beer, you know, the Boston accent, how they don't really pronounce their R's very strongly. So if I'm ever at a scene of a lone wolf operation, if I have to say something, I'll say it, you know, and I practice accents all the time. You know, I don't have the English one anywhere even remotely close, but I can do a pretty good New England accent in the course of a conversation. So I talk uncharacteristic of me. I dress uncharacteristic of me. And I was within feet, mere feet, of people who know me, and they didn't even spot me because their minds couldn't make that paradigm shift. They had a certain image of me in their mind, and I went totally counter to what they think I am. And that's exactly what General Gribas did. It says here that the EOKA second wave of attacks came in June. The first victim of the campaign was a policeman killed by a bomb, blew a hole in the wall of a divisional police headquarters in Nicosia. 16 men were wounded. A sergeant was killed when an assault group attacked the Amiados police station, and several other stations were attacked. Gribas had personally selected a target. The commander-in-chief of the British land forces in the Middle East, General Knightley, who was accustomed to drive daily in the capital from his home on the Kyrenia coast. Sorry about that. And I found a good place for an ambush on a pass over the Kyrenia Mountains, writes Gribas. But Archbishop Makarios vetoed the plan, and the idea was abandoned. You'll find out that this archbishop that General Gribas was dealing with all the time was always, you know, this General Gribas wanted to do more brutal and more just, I mean, he really wanted to take it to the occupation forces' ass, but this archbishop was always in the way. Let that be a lesson. I mean, how many lessons do you need to learn that Christianity, mainstream Christianity, is a huge enemy of the white race? Interracial adoption is sponsored by Christian churches. The Christian church is bringing in millions, if not millions in North America from the third world. Like, we got enough human shit on the shores of North America. We don't need any more. If we were to close the borders today because of their prolific birth rate, they would still take this country completely from us, even if we were to close the borders today. So, the Christian church is a main enemy of the white race. And we need to deal with them in the most ruthless ways that you can imagine. You know, to come on, the kid gloves have got to come off. You know, I watch MMA stuff all the time, whether it's the UFC, whether it's World Extreme Cage Fighting on the Versus station. And last night, oh man, I had a great night last night. I watched a fight for the troops on Spike TV last night. And there's this fighter named Steve Cantwell, white guy, young guy too, only 22 years old. What I like about this Steve Cantwell, he has a fire in him. When he gets, punched in the face a few times, this guy does not get intimidated. I mean, he continues to move forward and trying his best to take it through his opponent's ass. And last night he fought this pretty muscularly fit black guy by the name of Razak Al-Hassan. I thought for a second, when I saw his name in his picture, I thought maybe he'd have like an African accent or whatever. But no, he was born and raised in, of all places, Des Moines, Iowa. All right? Like, you need to make the paradigm shift here, people, that a lot of places in the Midwest are no longer completely white anymore. But Steve Cantwell took it to him, man. He's moving forward. He got drilled a couple times, but he drilled the other guy a couple of times. Well, the fight went to the ground. He got him in an arm bar, and the black guy rolled over a couple times trying to get out of it, trying to neutralize the position. Steve Cantwell broke his arm. I mean, I'm not saying he made his arm bend a 90-degree angle against the way his arm is naturally supposed to bend, but it's at least 60 degrees. I mean, maybe 45, but I mean, he broke his arm. You saw the Chinese, they showed us close-up of it and everything. And what I like about this guy, which I don't see in a lot of white fighters, is that fire. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of good white fighters, but I mean, maybe I'm a little jealous of the mestizo fighters, man, because they're always like, they seem a little bit more, they seem to have a little bit more fire in the gut. Maybe I'm wrong on that. You know, if you guys have a comment about that, shoot it in. I'd be glad to hear it. And maybe Tom will read it on a future show. Maybe we can talk about it. But as of today, I was so impressed with that fight, I nominated today to be Steve Cantwell Day. Because he broke that fucking nigger's arm, and it was great. All right, the memoirs revealed that Makarios vetoed a good many plans proposed by the leader and often dragged his feet when Gribas would have forged boldly ahead. The archbishop held the purse strings. Without funds, Gribas was unable to proceed and was forced to reconsider some of his more drastic schemes. As, for example, when he wished to send execution squads to London to assassinate known Cypriot informers living in Britain on the rewards of their betrayal. You know what? The fact, and I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll say it again, the fact that Tom Martinez, Tim Zoll, T.J. Leiden, Dave Mazzella, and numerous, who's that one guy out in North Carolina who betrayed the order? Glenn Miller. I mean, Bo Gritz, or whatever the hell his name was, the guy that talked Weaver down from the mountain, who I believe is a racial sellout. I mean, and I know that may strike some people, you know, you may not like that, but from what I understand, the guy had like a Oriental wife or whatever. I mean, come on. But the fact that the betrayers of our race are walking around with breath in their lungs is a testament. It is a testament to how pussified our struggle is at this moment. Now, if I see stuff happen on the news and no one claims things, I want to automatically assume the best for us. And like I said, I'm speaking to the one percenters here. I'm speaking to the one percenters who don't want to use the run-of-the-mill tactics no more, who want to think outside the box, you know? And this guy, this archbishop, I mean, put the kibosh on a lot of plans that General Gribas had in mind. And, you know, you need to learn from that. Okay. Although Gribas says that at the onset he would have been able to, given 500 armed men to drive the British into the sea, the remark is not to be taken seriously. From the start, he saw very clearly that his victory would be a political rather than military. You know, I think that we can get some political victories. I'm not talking about getting people to run for public office. That day is done. You know, I mean, Tom Metzger got a good percentage of the votes of the largest voting district in the country, or one of the largest, and he was barred from taking his seat. I mean, you know, you've heard that story many times on Insurgent Radio. So, you know, those days are done. We're not going to run for political office no more. And that's one thing that I wish that the NSM would learn. To run for political office is an exercise in the utmost futility. It will not go anywhere. You may, you know, that may happen if the United States was to fracture up into little principalities and little countries or whatever. I mean, that would be great if Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio made one country, and then the Northeast could be their other, and, you know, we could just mop up this problem slowly in segments. But the remark is not to be taken seriously. But from the start, he saw very clearly he would not get a military victory, but a political one. This is made clear in the general plan which he drew up in Athens 2 years before the first bomb exploded in Nicosia. Number one, the objective, to arouse international public opinion, especially among the allies of Greece, by deeds of heroism and self-sacrifice, which will focus attention on Cyprus until our aims are achieved. The British must be continuously harassed and beset until they are obliged by international diplomacy exercised through the United Nations to examine the Cyprus problem and settle it in accordance with the desires of the Cypriot people and the whole Greek nation. Now, if I was to write this objective, I would reword the first part. I would say that we of the white race in North America want to arouse international inspiration. That we want our actions copied in Australia, New Zealand, all of Europe, all of Russia, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and Canada. That we want the white diaspora that created these nations, that created the infrastructure and the complex laws and governmental policies that can only come from the minds of the white race, that we want these nations back, and we will not share our power with people who are black, brown, and yellow. Okay, so we would want to arouse international inspiration, especially among the white race of the white diaspora, with deeds of heroism and self-sacrifice. You hear that, white insurgents of America? You know, I think maybe the rest of the world may look to white racist insurgents. Maybe they're looking for us to take the lead. But so far, do who I see who has the most balls in this whole struggle are, believe it or not, skinheads in Russia and Hungary and other Eastern European nations. Maybe because they're not as contaminated with Christianity as we are. Okay, number two, as the way Grievous would write it, the procedure, number two. Activity will be aimed to causing so much confusion and damage in the ranks of the British force as to make it manifest abroad, turning the page, that they are no longer in complete control of the situation. The campaign will be carried out on all three fronts. Number one, sabotage against government installations and military posts. Two, attack on British forces by a considerable number of armed fighting groups. Three, organization of passive resistance by the population. Because of the difficulties in the way of large-scale guerrilla struggle, the main weight of the campaign will be placed on sabotage. Hear that? I think we've talked about that before. We're not going to get 10 or 20 guys and wear fatigues and load up on, you know, AR-15s and AKs and go out in the woods and say that we're our own army. We're not going to do stupid shit like that. I recommend that we keep our groups small and manageable and uninfiltratable. 5 to 6 men, no more. But you can do a lot with 5 to 6 men. Now these guys, these insurgents in Cyprus, they numbered no more than 100. You know, gangs would die off in certain actions, they would be replaced, but this was not a big outfit here, these Cypriot insurgents. They were a small group, and they broke themselves off into even smaller groups. What I say we do, we in North America need to form small groups, relationships with guys that you've known for years, who possibly you've shed blood with, and you've seen them shed blood. So you know they're not an informant, you know that they're not infiltrator or agent provocateur. And these groups are self-governing. They are autonomous. They are their own boss. They do their own thing. The only way you can make contact coordinate with another group is when the system becomes very, very weak. Other than that, do your own thing. Form a small group and just do your own thing. You don't have public meetings. You don't try to recruit people. You have enough people. You have enough training at your disposal through the insurgent, through the DVDs and videotapes that I've given Tom Metzger, who has made copies of them, and is willing to send you them. You don't even have to pay for them. Just write and say, hey, give me the one on combat pistol craft, and anything you have on combat pistol craft and tactics and whatnot. I've sent Tom Metzger some good shit, and you guys need to be bombarding him not only with donations, but with requests for these things. You need to seek out training on your own. Stop reading Mein Kampf. And, yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to keep a copy of it in your storage facility, but God damn, I mean, we already know what the problem is. Yeah, the Jews are part of the problem, but not the main problem. We need to straighten out our own ways first. Fighting groups support the cover of Saboteurs. Where was I at? Our success will not be achieved by minor or intermittent attacks, but only by a continuous campaign aimed at getting important results. It should not be supposed that by these means we should expect to impose a total material defeat on the British forces. Our purpose is to bring about a moral defeat by keeping up the offensive until the objectives stated in the first paragraph of this plan are realized. You know what? If you think you're going to secede from any part of the United States, we need to be about subversion. We need to be about sabotage in any ways and means possible. I'll leave that up to your own imagination, but sabotage needs to be a part of your vocabulary of self-talk. Remember what I talked about the other day? Before you go on a hop, you want to set a goal, an attainable goal, that you, yourself, or your group can attain. You want to visualize days and weeks in advance. And you go through the motions of your lone wolf hop, and you always, when you visualize this, you always visualize success. You always visualize you succeeding in every aspect of the plan. If you want to play a little mental mind game with yourself and maybe think of contingencies that will go wrong, and you already mentally experimenting with actions at the objective that you would do in case this contingency happened, that's fine. So you want to set a goal. You want to visualize success at your operation. You want to self-talk only positive. I can do this. I can be an insurgent. I am a revolutionary. Tom Metzger said a number of shows ago that if you think about something long enough and you think about it all the time, you will become it. Soul man think it, soul man be it. So that's what you need. Your mind needs to be completely, fanatically consumed with racial revolution and insurgency and sabotage and, you know, and winning a victory for the white race, because we have the moral high ground. If these current trends continue as they are, and I'm not saying, well, you know, I do believe the system has a goal of exterminating the white race for various reasons that I believe they want to do. But it's all about money. It's all about control. It's all about the banking cartels and their, you know, sphere of influence want to be the new tyrants of the world. You know, in days gone by, and years and centuries ago, it was always military guys who were the tyrants, and the bankers maybe were pissed off about that throughout antiquity and the past millennium, and they you know had to be the purse strings for a Napoleon or a Hitler or a Stalin, and they don't want to do that no more. They want to be the tyrant, and that's what's happening now. No longer is the military man the tyrant now. The military man, the man who kicked ass on the battlefield and raised through the ranks to the rank of 4-star generals, who are nothing but pussies now. They see what's happening to our race and they don't want to lift a finger. Fuck you! I hope you die a violent fucking death at the very most, at the very least. I hope you choke on a fucking chicken bone and you cough a bucket of blood, you sellout motherfuckers. But we have the moral high ground. And something I want to reiterate here, sabotage against government installation and military posts. Attack on British forces by a considerable number of armed fighting groups that number no more than 5 or 6. Organization of passive resistance by the population. I'm not sure how much time I have left. I think I have 15 minutes left, but... Oh man, you know what? I have a lot of reading to do in this chapter. I have pages left, but this is a great chapter of War of the Fleet. Chapter 8, General Grievous on Guerrilla War in Cyprus. You know, I don't know. I mean, I know I'm beating a dead horse here with some of the things I'm saying, but I think one thing I've learned in the military, that repetition over and over again becomes part of your subconscious. You know, we have a saying, pay attention to detail. You know, stay alert, stay alive. You know, in a way, I mean, I do want to militarize. If I can have any influence in this struggle before my days are done, I want to have a militant influence on the one percenters of the struggle. I mean, you think about it. Out of the millions of white people are on this planet, I would say maybe 5% are racially aware, whether they're racially aware in the closet or overtly. And less than 2% maybe are part of organizations that don't go nowhere, that just, you know, they're in the playpen and they're really not causing any damage to the system. They're really no threat. There's all kind of infiltrators in their group, and their infiltrators say the right things. Yeah, your infiltrator and your group out there, if you're listening, he's going to say the right things. He's going to talk about the niggers and the spits with a lot of conviction, maybe even with misty eyes. You know, oh man, my sister was raped by a nigger. You know, I mean, you know, they're going to have their shit together. I mean, this Tony Evola guy, I have it on good knowledge that he was schooled by the FBI to infiltrate the World Church and Creator. He was given classes, I mean, blocks of instruction on how to act like a racist. Tony Evola, I have it on good knowledge, did not want to say the word nigger. He had to be forced to say the word nigger. And I'm not going to reveal my sources because my source works in the courts. So, you guys got to get your act together. You got to realize that, you know, someday there's not going to be any more breath in our lungs. And, you know, I would believe, you know, I love the movie Troy with Brad Pitt. And, I love the narrative intro in the beginning of it, where the guy says, men are haunted by the vastness of eternity. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said that they wonder if their days will live on for eternity. You know, I remember when Brad Pitt's character Achilles had to go fight the big guy from the Thessalonians, Boagrius, I think his name was, and he told the little kid, and the little kid said, I wouldn't want to fight this guy, he's so big. And Brad Pitt's character, Achilles, says, and that's why no one will remember your name. You know what? As long as the white race is alive, I believe that Robert J. Matthews will always be remembered by a certain segment of the white race. If there's white people alive 100 years from now, David Lane and Robert J. Matthews, and I hope, you know who is faded into obscurity is Joe Tomasi. We need to reclaim him. We need to talk about him more. We need to learn about him more. What was good about him is he didn't start off in the organizations. He went from 0 to 60. He went from normal civilian to radical, racial radical in just like a very short period of time. You know, George Lincoln Rockwell, it was one of his own that assassinated him. We are our own worst enemy, and we need to deal. We need to deal with those of the white race that have betrayed us even more brutally than you could ever imagine meeting out to a nigger or a spick or a chink or a sand nigger, a fucking niggadoo Hindu. I mean, You need to walk out your door and say, you're about to witness the strength of street knowledge, nigger. You know, and really take it to the system's ass. And anyone of our race that is white, that has sold us out, absolutely deserve no mercy. I'm not talking about, you know, picketing in front of your home. I'm talking about no fucking mercy. And once we start cleaning up our own house, I'm not saying that needs to be on number one. You know, if some of you out there want to focus on that, hey, you're more than welcome to do that. You know, my days are numbered as they are. I'm going to talk as radically as I possibly can. I'm sure Tom Mester will edit what he doesn't want going on his show. And he's more welcome to do that, and I will not be mad at him for doing that. I leave it up to his discretion on what should go over the waves and what should not. But if we do not become ruthless, remember, I mean, I watch all these episodes of Gangland, and the gangs that are ruthless, I mean, bloodthirsty, ruthless, brutal motherfuckers are the ones that get all the respect. And that's just the way human nature is. Nobody wants to fuck with the crazy ones, the ones that will chop your head off and put it on a spike. No one wants to mess with them. Even law enforcement is wary of messing with them. Okay? There's parts of L.A. where the cops don't even want to go through. The gangs rule it and run it. You know, what does that say? So, do the right reading. You need to be training in physical fitness every day. If you have a proclivity towards alcohol, stop. If you smoke, stop. If you smoke marijuana, stop. If you do drugs, stop. Because you are, continue to do these things, you are useless for our cause, and you are no good for the white race. So, I bid you guys in 14 words, we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children, and 5 words. Don't let no one, don't let no federal agent bait you into an argument when they come knocking your door. That happened to me like 8 months ago. They baited me into an argument just to get me to talk. I didn't tell them anything revealing, but I shouldn't have argued with them at all. Don't be baited into an argument. Don't let, I mean, these guys are trained to act like your best friend. They have key phrases. Come on, you need to help yourself out here. Come on, tell us what happened. You need to think about yourself. You need to think about yourself and your future. You need to help yourself out here. That's the key phrase they use. And every time they get one of these guys to talk, they still do years and years.
Well, boys and girls, that was a fiery session, but unfortunately, Guerrilla Radio Man's got a crummy phone there. We're going to have to make some changes there. It wasn't my equipment this time, so... but you can understand what he's saying, so just write that off as he's out in the field, he's operating from a very rough situation, and he's trying to get the word out to you. So anyhow, that's the reason for the distortion on his voice. But we will take care of it. And that's it for Insurgent Radio Show B, December the 11th, 2008, and 14 in 5 words.
Chug on a mountain road, I got a hot rod pick and I'm flying low. Eyes are full of this diesel smoke and these hairpin curves ain't no joke. Diesel smoke.